the Working Class Art of Ralph Fasanella.
He has on his tombstone as an epithet, it says, remember who you are, remember where you came from, don't forget the past, change the world.
That's the artist's son, Mark Fasanella. We talk with him this hour, first about his father and the new book he edited about him, Ralph Fasanella, Images of Optimism. Then we turn to Mark Fasanella's own project to change the world, the Ecological Culture Initiative. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. For many years, I had a poster-sized print of Ralph Fasanella's painting, The Great Strike, Lawrence, hanging in my living room. One of a series, it depicts a Lawrence textile workers' strike of 1912 in brilliantly colored detail. I fell in love with Fasanella's work, its narrative power and passion for social justice, and the sheer joy of its imagery, even when depicting tragic events like the assassinations of Martin Luther King and JFK. So last year, when I walked into the house of Mark Fasanella to interview him for another radio program I produce, I was awestruck to find paintings of one of my favorite artists all over his walls. That day, I was there to ask Fasanella about his own work, which we'll hear about later. But when he told me he was working on a book about his father, I knew I had to invite him to Writer's Voice. Ralph Fasanella was aptly born on Labor Day, 1914, to an Italian immigrant family in New York City. His father was an iceman, his mother was a buttonhole maker. Ralph Fasanella grew up to become a labor organizer, and then he became a painter, self-taught, taking as his main subject the working people of New York City and the things that define their lives. He painted in obscurity for 30 years before being discovered. The painting my poster depicted, The Great Strike, was given to Congress by a group of unions, where it hung for years in the hearing room for the House Subcommittee on Labor and Education. When the Republicans took over Congress, they returned it to the unions. Mark Fasanella is the founder and director of the Ecological Culture Initiative in Hampton Bays, New York, and taught ecological architecture and design at Stony Brook University and elsewhere. Well, Mark Fasanella, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you.
This book is about your dad, Ralph Fasanella. He's a name that's not well known among the many, but very well known among the few, and I don't mean the 1%. I mean folks who know about the labor movement, folks who know about art and the labor movement and activist art.
Yeah.
Tell us who your dad was. Was Ralph Fasanella?
Sure. My father is the son, was the son of Italian immigrants from a city called Lavello, Italy. It's a very small medieval city. It's only known now for a Fiat plant and peaches, so it's still kind of a sleepy place. But they emigrated to the United States because there wasn't much work there at the time. There was no Fiat factory. And his father, Giuseppe, worked as an iceman. His mother worked as a seamstress in the famed Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, famed for a fire that happened before she worked there, that a lot of young women jumped from the windows because the emergency doors were locked. And they died, and so it became kind of an infamous, it's now part of NYU's campus at Greenwich, in, around Washington Square Park. But he grew up, and his mother became radicalized working in the textile factory, and he became radicalized through that, radicalized in the sense that he saw the injustices that were happening to workers, especially to immigrant workers. And, of course, those same issues still exist today. I always used to tell my students that you know, when we looked at Rome, ancient Rome, and I see teaching the history of architecture, they talk about slaves and citizens, and so it just confuses me. If you have somebody who's a non-citizen, I don't know quite how you square that in the 21st century, how you have somebody who's you consider a non-citizen. Do they have no rights? Are they a slave? I mean, what's the situation? So my father kind of understood that context as a teenager growing up. And then he went to fight in the Spanish Civil War. So he was labeled by the U.S. government at the time as what was called a premature anti-fascist. In other words, he was an anti-fascist too early. So he was against Hitler and Mussolini's takeovers and General Franco of Spain before it was popular to be so. So he's blacklisted in the McCarthy era. He came back from Spain. He worked as a machinist for a short time, was not a very good machinist, but was very good at talking, and he became a union organizer. And while he was union organizer, he started, he was very restless. He was constantly restless. His fingers were bothering him, and a friend of his suggested he take up sketching. And he started sketching, and then he declared himself an artist a few years after that. And he did have to do a bunch of different types of jobs over the years, mostly working at one of his brother's gas stations or owning his own gas station in the Bronx. But he started painting really as his main means of expressing himself when he was in his 30s and continued up until his death in 1997.
And that triangle, shirtwaist fire, that's so interesting that your grandmother worked there. My great aunt worked there, and she didn't actually work there. My great aunt witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire.
Oh, wow.
And she became a member of the Socialist Workers' Party as a result.
Oh. Uh-huh.
So it was a very radicalizing event in New York City with the labor movement there. So your dad, Ralph Fasanella, the title of this beautiful book that you've come out with here, Ralph Fasanella, Images of Optimism. Why that title?
Well, a couple of reasons. When most of my formative years, I always thought my father's work would be known in the future for his most radical political paintings. And at the beginning of the book, there's a great introductory essay by the curator of contemporary self-taught art at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, Leslie Umberger. So she wrote this essay that actually chronicles a lot of that part of his artwork. And that's what I always thought would be the thing that would make his name. But the older I get and the way my career trajectory evolved, I ended up teaching ecological design and looking kind of how we create the built environment and the way we, as a society, kind of structure our relationship to the ecosystem that's around us. And I looked back at his canvases through that lens and realized there was a kind of a utopian vision. So he had two things, this vision of dystopia, where the world that he was living in had flaws. So he chronicled the execution of the Rosenbergs, which at the time there's a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism, and so executing a Jewish New York Jewish couple was a very chilling thing for people who are progressive. The Kennedy assassination, the sexual revolution, and the very important strike that happened in Lawrence, Massachusetts, you know, these were all kind of clashes of culture against people kind of railing against and bumping up against the tragedies of their time and injustice of their time. But then he painted a lot of canvases that were much more calm and relaxed and reflective, and they were images of, there's a great painting called Old Neighborhood that's kids playing stickball in the streets, kind of an 1890s scene, and he was born in 1914, so it's really before his time, but he understood what the Bronx looked like when he moved to the Bronx as an older teen. You know, there were still wood frame buildings and open lots, wooded lots. So he understood what an earlier time had looked like. It seemed kind of more peaceful to him. And then he kind of followed that through the years and always had these paintings that were kind of street scenes that were at a human scale, not at this kind of scale in his political canvases where he steps back and it's this, there's all these invented perspectives. You can see all these details and these dramas that are playing out, political dramas that are playing out, and social dramas that are playing out. In his smaller, more folk-like paintings, he has these images of what he sees as utopia, and that had a profound effect on me. And, of course, we're living in a time, one of my students pointed out to me, that we have no utopias. If you look at all of our films, our video games, our operas, all of them kind of depict a dystopian future. So I thought it was important that his work, as he really chronicled the 20th century and we're entering the 21st, it was important to look back at his work and other people's work who have these images of what a more utopian future could look like.
And a utopian future that really draws on the traditions of the past.
Exactly. And I think that's something that's really essential. He has on his tombstone as an epithet, it says, remember who you are, remember where you came from, don't forget the past, change the world. So that's an adaptation or paraphrasing of something he probably heard along the way. I've heard other people say similar things. But that really was important to him, that we didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's something that in the 21st century, as we came out of the 20th and the 21st, we still have this notion that technology can solve any problem, and that will, through pharmaceuticals or through solar panels or wind turbines, we're going to kind of invent our way out of the problems that we have. But a lot of the problems that we have are cultural problems and structural problems in the way we construct our society. So that's the kind of scale at which we operate. There's a film that I started a nonprofit a couple of years ago, and there's a film that we showed called More Than Honey, and there's a beekeeper who brings bees around the country to pollinate crops, and he says total global domination, that's the goal. And that really is for many people in the turn of the 20th to 21st century, but that kind of concept is what's causing the problems that we're having. Even some of the problems we're having in Texas right now with flooding is because we have this kind of system of creating suburbia and creating cities that they're not really unique. You go in, it's the same stores on every main street and the same type of buildings and the same, they're not adapted to the environment they're in. And my father understood that there was a importance to understanding place and having some place evolve forward from its past.
Hmm. Yeah, and you know that essay that you cite in this book, Images of Optimism, the writer of that essay, and tell us her name again.
Leslie Umberger. She wrote the introductory essay, which is called Lest We Forget.
Right. So Umberger says that at a certain point, your father, Ralph Fasanella, faced a personal tug of war between traditional and progressive values. Is this some of what you're talking about? What was the tug of war, and how did he resolve it, if he did?
Well, I think that where he lived in a time where there still was, there's a great painting he made called Family Supper, which is at Ellis Island Museum, and that's a great example of this kind of traditional meal where you'd sit down, the family would get together, you'd sit down, you'd have a meal every night. It wasn't a special Sunday tradition. It was something you would do every night, and people cooked and cleaned together. And that's something that we lost as we moved into the modern time with the TV dinners and people having different schedules. So, you know, progressive in the sense that you want to have justice and for all and equal wages for people who are doing equal work, and access to medical care and education. Those are the things that he was progressive about, not trying to move away from a class structure or an estate structure where you have people who are deemed, ordained by God as superior to others. That he was moving away from as a progressive. But losing all of those aspects of life, family life and community life and neighborhood life, where you knew a grocer and they would extend credit to you if they knew you were having a hard time. They didn't have credit cards, but the grocer would give you groceries knowing that you'd be good for it. You know, that kind of fabric of a community is something that he wanted to hang on to.
So tell us about his relationship to art. You mentioned before self-taught. He was self-taught. What kinds of influences, if any, did he have on his work?
Well, he was a union organizer, and he was a very self-educated guy. He always said he graduated from NYU, New York Unemployed. He got out of the sixth grade, and some of that schooling was in a protectory where he was basically incarcerated for petty theft as a kid. So he really educated himself. He read voraciously at a huge library. I have some of his library, and I'm renting a 5x10 storage unit to keep his books in. I probably got rid of five times the amount of those books. So he read all of the books that he had. So he read voraciously, and he also went to museums. He spent a tremendous amount of time visiting Museum of Modern Art and contemporary art galleries that were in the 1930s. You know, that was really the beginning of the whole modernist art movement. And he knew people like Ed Reinhardt. He was into jazz, and he was living in Greenwich Village, so he kind of rubbed shoulders with the intelligentsia, the zeitgeist of that time. So he knew what abstract art was. But to him, it seemed very disassociated with the life of the working class. So if you look at his paintings, it's a very interesting fusion of very abstract compositions, especially his big, large political canvases, very abstract compositions that are layered, and then he creates this almost Gothic perspective, all of these different perspectives. So he taught himself how to create a composition, an all-over composition, where eye is constantly moving around the piece and noticing new details. He taught himself how to do that through looking at both abstract art that was happening around him and then looking at Goya and Diego Rivera, who, of course, at that time, was his work was very important in progressive social circles, and the art of the WPA. And he also studied Van Gogh, who he was passionate about, and the other Impressionists. So he really schooled himself. I mean, and he never stopped absorbing both, you know, he would look at art and see what he could take from it that he could use. So in some of his canvases, you'll see Impressionist skies or you'll see an abstract sky, and he was taking elements from the things that he was studying.
What's so striking for me about his paintings is the incredible narrative detail married with the symbolic element that he puts into so many of them.
Yes, and I think part of that comes from spending that time in the Catholic Protectory. He always talked about how the stained glass windows, although he didn't have a very good religious experience there because some of the brothers that were taking care of the children could be very brutal, he really took from it the emotional impact that the windows could have. Because, of course, stained glass windows were invented at a time when 99.9% of people were illiterate, so they really served the purpose of graphic novels in those great cathedrals of Europe, and then that tradition carried on into Catholic churches in the United States and other churches. But the Protectory he was in had these big stained glass windows, and the colors and the mood and the kind of the way those windows could affect you and frighten you or enlighten you, you know, that I think he tried to bring into his work. And then that also is part of that idea of creating these little details, these little narrative details, like a graphic novel, that are filling you in on what the inhabitants of an apartment are doing in the face of an apartment building, or a vision of what might be happening in the sky. What somebody's dreaming or thinking of, or what's happening underground. You know, these things are all kind of revealed and opened up to you in his big, large panoramic works.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Mark Fasanella about his father, artist Ralph Fasanella. There's a new book that he's come out with about his dad. It's called Images of Optimism. Your dad did some really wonderful paintings, actually a series about his own parents, about his father in particular, the Iceman Crucified series. Talk a little bit about them. Describe them.
Sure. He used that series in that Family Supper painting I mentioned before. You can see both his mother crucified on the cross with a needle and thread and a sewing machine at her feet, and his father crucified on a wall calendar with ice tongs. And then he did a series of paintings of his father as crucified with ice tongs, ice pick, on the cross, and then ice tongs at his head and a bucket of ice at his feet. So his father was an ice man. He had a horse and wagon and delivered ice to the tenements of New York City. And he used his father, who actually, his mother, when she became radicalized by a union organizer. And she and my grandfather on my father's side split up. And my grandfather, Giuseppe Joe, went back to Italy, and my father didn't see him after his late teens. So he had kind of a strained relationship. He was the father he knew up until that period of his life. He used to ride in the ice truck with him and talk about how he struggled and he could never really get ahead. He had all of his children that he was raising, and you know, it was just very difficult for him to make his way in this new world. And so he uses his father as just an example, an analogy of every working person who struggles their entire life and can never really seem to get ahead. And especially being illiterate, which his father was, whereas his mother was literate, you know, he really didn't fully understand the context that he was in and couldn't understand why, you know, he was suffering. So he uses it as a symbol of the suffering of the working man. And in the bottom of that Family Supper painting on the left-hand side, it says, "In memory of my father, Joe, poor bastard died broke, and to all Joes who died same."
Wow. I remember first seeing your dad's work when I was doing work with the labor movement. I'm not sure how I came into possession of a print of his marvelous painting about the 1912 Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. That's part of a series as well. Tell us about that series. And that was something you went around, you spent some time going with him to the mills while he was developing that series.
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a unspoken history in Lawrence because it was a very important place, Lawrence, Massachusetts, in the American version of the Industrial Revolution. It was the first place on Earth where water rights were sold because they dug all of these canals to power the mills with water. And it was a huge textile industry. And, of course, the mills were populated by immigrants, so they were paying low wages. And it reached a point where they were pitting. They had up to 30 different immigrants, types of immigrants, you know, people from Hungary and people from Lithuania and people from Poland and people from Italy and people from Ireland. They had all these different people working in the mills. And, of course, they didn't speak a common language. So they were kind of able to use one ethnic group against another in competing for the jobs, and they would drive the wages down. So they were working 6.5 days a week, sun up till sundown, which are long days in the summer and shorter days in the winter, but exhausting days, and the safety conditions were really bad. People would get scalped or amputated all the time. There were huge leather belts that went up to the ceiling that connected to pulleys that would connect to the water wheel at the end of the building. So there was a strike that came about. It was brought on by the International Workers of the World, the IWW, in 1912, and they were trying to get essentially standardized wages. The strike happened because they wanted to, the government wanted them to actually standardize wages so there wouldn't be all of these interruptions in work. And the mill owners got together and said, sure, we'll standardize wages, but we'll raise the wage but cut everybody's work hours. So it didn't really work out that they were going to be able to get ahead anyway, the workers. So they had this strike and they brought in armed guards. There were clashes between the male strikers and the guards, and then all the women and children went out on strike, and a woman and a child were struck down by a National Guardsman, and it got international headlines at the time. And then there was this kind of dark memory of it in Lawrence. The mills eventually closed. They went to the Carolinas and then to Vietnam, and now China and Indonesia. So the mills were kind of a forgotten part of their past. There were some illegal mills running. And when my father and mother were having some difficulty in their relationship, my father went up to Lawrence, Massachusetts, and had some friends there, and he got into the mills and started talking to people. And there had been books written about it, but it wasn't a celebrated part of Lawrence's past. And the more people he talked to, the more the stories came out, the more excited he got about it and got people excited about it, and it led to this whole renaissance of understanding the history and the importance of Lawrence in the industrial labor movement. And now they have an annual festival. My father was honored 1 year, two years. He was honored while he was alive, and then he was honored posthumously, and I accepted the award on his behalf at this Lawrence Heritage Festival. And they all actually have a museum called the Lawrence Heritage Museum, which has one of my father's big mill paintings up there.
And we are talking with Mark Fasanella about his father, artist Ralph Fasanella. The new book out about Ralph Fasanella with gorgeous reproductions of his paintings is called Images of Optimism. Now, you mentioned before that your dad had been, he had been blacklisted during the McCarthy period. First, tell us, what did it mean for him to be blacklisted? Was that as an artist, or did he have trouble getting a job?
No, it's funny. I was talking to some people yesterday, actually, about dates I was going to put on my calendar, and all of a sudden, my phone filled in the dates. I started typing something, and it filled in the dates automatically, because I'm told that my iPhone is listening to me. So that kind of thing was happening to my father. There were people, during the McCarthy era, there was a tremendous push to try to rid left-wing progressives from government jobs, from any kind of important positions, teachers, librarians, administrators of any kind. So my father was working as union organizer at the time, which obviously made him even more suspect. And so they had all kinds of spies in the midst, you know, people who were being paid by the government to kind of watch individuals. And so if he had a get-together with a bunch of progressive friends, it would be deemed a communist cell meeting. And actually, a filmmaker did a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, and got the files, and we looked through them. And it really is laughable because, you know, it's Ralph Fasanella, a.k.a. Ralph Patrick Fasanella. I mean, it's all information that is just public information, and they talk about cocktail parties he had, who was in attendance, and then you can see there's nothing really there. But when he did apply for jobs at that time, there would be somebody following him. It would come in, or if he got the job, they'd come in after he got the job and started and said, you know, you really don't want to hire this guy. He's a red. So he wasn't able to get work. So he ended up working for one of his brothers who owned a gas station, just pumping gas. And that's how he got through that period. A lot of progressive people kind of helped each other out. But he was never, you know, had he been a member of the Communist Party? Yes, when he was young, he was probably a member of the Communist Party. He went to Spain and fought against Franco. But he was never dogmatic. He was never somebody who said, you know, I have these political beliefs that I'm holding on to. He evolved with the times that he lived in. So he certainly wasn't somebody who was trying to sell atomic secrets to the Russians or anything like that. He simply was hoping that workers would get equal pay, access to health care, and those were just things that were not expected to be given to people at that time.
And we're still struggling for that.
Yes, absolutely.
Days. So how did he get discovered? There's a wonderful quote here. A journalist wrote an article about him, said, "This man pumps gas in the Bronx for a living. He may also be the best primitive painter since Grandma Moses." So first tell us how he got discovered.
So Nicholas Pledge, I'm not sure who the first person was. He had a show at a place called Automation House. If I'm not mistaken, at that show, either Nicholas Pledge or Milton Glaser, a very well-known graphic designer, an art director who was part of what was called the New York School in the 1970s, saw that work. In 1972, they saw the paintings, either Nicholas Pledge or Milton Glaser. I think it might have been Milton. And they had just put out New York Magazine, which still exists, but when Milton Glaser was running it and Clay Felker, it was what Time Out New York is now. It was just this incredible resource for people, where to eat cheaply, what to go see, what plays to go see, what art to go see. So Nicholas Pledge came to interview my father. They developed a fantastic relationship. They kind of understood each other as people, and they published this beautiful article in New York Magazine, which immediately had a huge impact. It was not too long after he was able to leave his job, leave his gas station, and start painting full-time because the prices for paintings. When I was very young, I remember going with my parents and hanging his paintings, chain link fences, at art fairs and selling them for, you know, $100 or something. But the prices went up to $1,000 or a few thousand dollars very quickly after that article. And I've gone up since then. There was a painting, the highest painting price ever paid for a painting was in 1996, and it was $360,000, and there's paintings that have been sold around that price since then. So
wow. So the label primitivism, is that a label he would have accepted?
No, because primitivism means basically that you're backward, and there's a whole discussion going on now. They don't use that as much. They use outsider art and self-taught. And so he never liked that label primitive because he didn't feel that he was primitive because he had read so voraciously. He was incredibly self-educated, and he knew he wasn't primitive. His best friend was a PhD in history from the University of Chicago, and they could talk for hours about politics and history. So he never felt primitive, but he certainly was self-taught and brought an approach to painting, a directness to painting that is unacademic in a formal sense, in a technical sense, which, like anything else, you know, it can be, it's like a jazz musician who doesn't read music. It can be freeing in a way because you don't feel hemmed in by the constraints of the canon or the paradigm of what is in your kind of your own person in that world. But what made him also not primitive is that he knew what was happening in the art world. He was very much a man of his times and understood what was happening both in the art world and in the society around him, and was able to depict it on canvas.
Now, we mentioned before that you went around with him when he went up to the mill towns for the paintings about the Lorne strike. What did you learn about him when you accompanied him on those trips?
He was an incredibly verbal guy. He really, as much as he could speak with a brush and oil and paint on canvas, he was able to speak in person with people, and people from all different walks of life. I mean, it didn't matter whether they were governor or the custodian. And my mother always said that if he got onto an elevator with, you know, three people, by the time he got to the third floor, he knew everybody, what they did for a living, where they lived. And sometimes that conversation would continue on for 30 years afterwards because he had that ability to kind of just approach people and immediately initiate a conversation.
He must have been a great union organizer.
Yes, exactly. And then traveling around with him, you know, it just gave you access to places that most people, you know, you go to a baseball game and he knew which guy to go see and pay them $20 and sneak into the baseball game. Or if you had to park your car in a full parking lot, you could park your car in a full parking lot because he had kind of an eye. And he just, because he was self-taught, he had intellectual depth, so he could speak to people who were far better educated than he was in a formal sense. But he also had a very working class identity, so he could talk to somebody who, you know, was working in a very mundane job.
And we've been talking about Ralph Fasanella, the wonderful artist, self-taught artist, a labor union organizer, and dad of my guest, Mark Fasanella. Thank you so much for telling us about him and about this new book, Images of Optimism.
Thank you.
For those who live on the east end of Long Island, Mark Fasanella will be speaking about the book, Ralph Fasanella, Images of Optimism, at Kenio's Books in Sag Harbor on September 16th at 5 p.m. You can see his father's painting, The Great Strike, Lawrence, at writersvoice.net. And we'll be back with Mark Fasanella after the break, talking about his ecological culture initiative. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Some listeners may know that in addition to Writer's Voice, I co-produce another radio show, Sustainable East End. It airs monthly on WPKN out of Bridgeport, Connecticut, and serving Eastern Long Island as well as Southern Connecticut. Earlier this year, my co-producer Tony Ernst and I traveled to Mark Fasanella's house to interview him for the show about the organization he founded and directs, the Ecological Culture Initiative. The ECI's mission is to bring sustainability to the community of Hampton Bays, New York, by posing ecological alternatives to destructive land use practices and growth-based development. Here's the interview my co-producer Tony Ernst and I did with Mark Fasanella earlier this year. So the Ecological Culture Initiative, the website outlines an amazing number of projects of this ecological cultural initiative. Give us a little snapshot of some of them, then we'll go in more deeply. And tell us what it's all about.
Sure. Well, what happened is we were having a lot of dinner conversations in this farmhouse that you're in about what are the things that are necessary to really make a community, what the phrase people use, sustainable. What would it really do? Because we have a serious water quality problem in Hampton Bays. We're surrounded by water, and there's a lot of attention being drawn to the die-offs that have happened in the bays. And so we were just talking and talking and talking. Richard Casabianco owns this house, has been a kind of lifelong historian and preservationist. And then I've been teaching ecological design at Stony Brook University for the past 8 years. So the more we thought about it, the more we realized it was all of these efforts to kind of look back through the past. One of my students, Nick Zanussi, who was from the East End, said that one of the things we have to do is kind of stop and let the past catch up to us before we rush headlong into the future. So we kind of looked at all the best aspects of what we had in the past, and then I've been teaching the most advanced regenerative principles, the kinds of things we can do to create the built environment that actually collaborates with the ecosystem instead of imposing on the ecosystem. So we put all those ideas together, and we looked at the different nonprofits that are serving the East End. And Hampton Bays really wasn't getting as much attention as some other communities. Beconic Land Trust does fantastic work. Group for the East End does fantastic work. Beconic Estuary Program. I mean, all of those nonprofits do great work, but Hampton Bays doesn't get a lot of their attention because it's not a farming community. Traditionally, it was a farming community, and that's something that we want to bring back. We want to have more local gardening and small farms in Hampton Bays to augment the fishing. And then people use the phrase ecotourism. Hampton Bays was probably a very early ecotourism place. People came out here to get out into the ecosystem, go into the woods and spend time in nature, sail. And so that's the kind of culture we want to restore to Hampton Bays, and then have the built environment advance in ways. For instance, there's no building code that says we should have passive solar buildings, but that's the kind of thing I think we should have in Hampton Bays. And we have some models. Laura Luciano, who's on our advisory board and a food writer. Her husband's an architect, and they have a passive solar house. So these things, you know, exist in Hampton Bays. There is one small farm that we hope to begin giving worth. A couple of small farms. Our agroecology director, Rachel Stevens, has a small farm, but there's one traditional one. So we want to kind of restore those elements of the past, both the architectural history, the farming history, the history of people coming out to actually enjoy the ecosystem, not necessarily on a, you know, a big machine, but just by spending time in nature. And that's what the Ecological Culture Initiative was founded to do.
So ecological design, what are the basic ideas that underlie it?
So rain harvesting, rainwater collection, there's really no reason we should be building any building in the 21st century that isn't harvesting rain, because the water that we're using both for irrigation and for our showers and as well as cooking and drinking comes from a thousands of year old aquifer. That's a pristine drinking water source, and we're using it at an alarmingly fast rate. Development has not stopped. We're still creating new developments all over Long Island, and we're pulling tons of water out of this to sprinkle it in our lawns, add fertilizer, petrochemical fertilizer, and fungicides and pesticides to it, and then flush it down storm drains as fast as we possibly can, back as close to that aquifer as fast as we can. So that's one example of ecological design. It's very simple. Every new building that should be made, every major renovation should harvest the rain that falls onto its roof. And then there are many other surfaces where we could harvest rain. Any non-permeable surface, roadway, pathways, we could be harvesting that rain. And then the principle there is to slow it down and then soak it into a complex biodiverse ecosystem before it sinks down towards the aquifer. Not have it, you know, shunt as fast as possible towards a storm drain, as close as possible as we can get it to the aquifer. So that's one example, passive solar design being another. And then landscape schemes and concepts of landscape that are far more biodiverse. The lawns that we have all over Long Island, all over the United States, if you look at Long Island, probably our number one crop is grass. And we're fertilizing it, and we're importing those fertilizers. Whereas a landscape that actually produces clean air and produces water, clean water for us, would have much, much greater biodiversity than that. So that's one of the other principles, is creating xeriscapes, landscapes that don't require any additional water or fertilizer than what is already in place. There are many, many plants that are adapted to this landscape. Victoria Bustamante, who is one of the owners of Warren's Nursery, is a one of many local native plant experts. And so she is working with Edwina von Gaal, who is in the East Hampton, is another one. But so those are the kinds of initiatives we want to get to happen. And we're working with the Hampton Bays Beautification Association right now to put a rain garden right in the center of Hampton Bays.
A rain garden.
Yeah, so what we want to do is take the rain off of a municipal building. We don't have all the permissions yet, so I won't say which building, but take all the rain that comes off a roof of a building right in the center of town, and then have one of these demonstration rain gardens so people can see the types of plants, the type of landscape, and they really have to be beautiful. There are other rain gardens on the East End, but not all of them are the type that somebody would walk by and say, "Ooh, I want that in front of my house." So we really want to make this a beautiful demonstration garden. The Parish Art Museum has some large, pretty developed examples of them along the walkways as you enter the museum. Those are all permeable surfaces and landscapes, and all the water that comes off the parking lots actually gets filtered through the plants before it gets down towards the aquifer.
Can we just back up a bit, Mark? Where are you from? What did you do before you got involved in this group?
So I was born and raised in Westchester County, north of the city, and my parents were lifelong activists. My mother was a public school teacher, and my father was a self-taught social realist painter. So I had people like Cesar Chavez and Pete Seeger in my house as I was growing up, and I became exposed to how people can really change the communities they live in and affect change. As far as my profession, I was trained to be a public school industrial arts and technology teacher. And over the years throughout my education, I apprenticed myself to estate gardening and restoration carpentry. And then I taught at Southampton College for 15 years. I taught graphic design and other design classes. And then when Southampton College closed, it was a very dark chapter of my life. I was transferred to CW Post. But I decided I didn't want to do that. And like a ray of sunshine, a bolt of lightning, the state bought that Southampton campus and open an environmental college, which is what I originally had wanted to do as a professor. So when they opened this environmental college, I jumped at the chance to work for Stony Brook Southampton. And then, of course, after a couple of years, the president of the Stony Brook University changed. They kind of downsized the Stony Brook Southampton campus, and I was shifted to a program at the main campus, a sustainability program. And I've been teaching in that program for 8 years. I just left that position, and it is in that position that I taught ecological art, architecture, and design. There are artists today who are using natural processes as their medium. And that's the kind of art that I was teaching. The design, as I was saying, the built environment, the landscape, how we create the landscape, how we create buildings that collaborate with ecosystems instead of imposing themselves or even integrating themselves, really collaborating with natural processes. And then the design really even goes to community behavioral systems. Buckminster Fuller said that environmental design is not only building a better physical environment for humankind, but also reforming behavioral patterns. So to give an example of that, I say this all the time, people roll their eyes and think I'm crazy for saying it, but Chesapeake Bay and other areas have studied what creates this excess nitrogen that's affecting our waterways on the east end. They had the same thing in the Chesapeake Bay. And one of the leading causes is meat consumption. So if we really cared about our ecosystem, we would eat less meat.
connect the dots.
Well, if you think about it, when you're eating meat, it's a whole lot of resources that keep getting condensed and condensed and condensed. So there's a tremendous amount of water, a tremendous amount of grain, a tremendous amount of nutrients that go into creating that ounce of meat that you're eating. And so it's a much more intense, it's harder for you to digest, and it produces more nitrogen in your urine in particular. And that's really the most dangerous thing. So we could adapt our diets to be, and that's just one example. The other would be other consumption practices. For instance, in the marinas, there's a tremendous amount of detergents being used and cleaning boats and waxing boats and, you know, and all of the processes that we use around our waterways. We should be extremely careful about what we're putting into our waterways. And the bulkheads and, you know, all the ways we look at that, we can really change our personal practices and the foods that we buy, too. So the more local the foods are, the greater we're increasing biodiversity. And you want to have farms that you know are using what's called polyculture, as opposed to having hundreds of acres in one type of crop. You want to have many, many crops. So Biophilia Farm on the North Fork is one of many examples where he does that kind of farming.
I love that name, Biophilia.
It's a great guy, Phil Manuele from Biophilia Farm.
If you've just joined Sustainable East End, we're talking with Mark Fasanella of the Ecological Cultural Initiative in Hampton Bays. So now tell us about some of the projects. You have a permaculture education center. Define permaculture for us and tell us what the center does.
Sure. That's our ultimate goal, is we'd actually like to make Hampton Bays a college town that has an academic program in it that is based in understanding and learning about these issues. So permaculture was invented by Bill Mollison in the 70s. And what he and a colleague did was they looked at all these different agricultural systems from around the world and tried to put them together and create a system, instead of agriculture, that would be a self-replenishing system, a regenerative system. And they came up with that term, permaculture. So I'm hoping next January, a year from now, we'll be offering a permaculture certificate. I just in Hampton Bays, I've been talking with a couple of property owners, and it looks like we have a property selected. And we just signed an agreement, the Ecological Culture Initiative, with the LIU Post Center for Sustainability. Scott Carlin, who runs that center, lives in Hampton Bays. And so we plan to bring that program to Hampton Bays. We have meetings with politicians over the next few weeks, and we'll start raising funds to create a permanent permaculture center and then build out academic programs around that. So that we're in the process of designing that, and we could sure use some help with fundraising for that project. And if people have any suggestions as to grants or people who would like to donate to that type of a project. But starting very small and locally, the first thing that we did was we actually have created a seed library. Rachel Stevens, our agroecology director, has created this fantastic seed library that'll open on March 8th at the Hampton Bays Public Library. It's open to anyone. The seeds are free. And we're trying to, once again, get more and more of this type of biodiversity of food in our local ecosystem.
So how does that work?
So there are many companies around the world that are trying to deal with this. There's a huge loss of biodiversity in foodstuffs. So there are many seed companies that are working hard, and they've been donating seeds to us. We're going to take those donated seeds and give them out to local people. You get about 10 to 20 seeds, depending on the size of the seeds, in a small packet. They're free. We're going to have classes on how to germinate them and propagate the plants and harvest. And then hopefully we can get community members to collect seeds, and you eventually create an ecotype. You start to get seeds that are hybridized on their own to the place where you live. They adapt to the conditions where you live. So that's really the ultimate goal of a seed library, is having this ongoing program. And so that's what we're starting at the Hampton Bays Public Library.
You also have the Good Ground Seed Library. You also have the Good Ground Restoration Project.
So that's really the umbrella term we're using for all of these efforts. If you think about restoration, it's not the same thing as renovation. And we've been doing a lot of renovation. So, for instance, in Hampton Bays, most of the houses were cedar-sided, and almost all of that's getting covered as new places are constructed with vinyl siding. Vinyl siding is a incredibly destructive product in its manufacture. It's very dangerous, the production process for the workers in the factory, and then there is absolutely no way to recycle it or use it for anything but landfill. People always say, well, it's maintenance-free. Not so much. If you look at the PVC fences and the vinyl siding, people have to power wash them. The hurricanes that we get take a tremendous toll and kind of rip them off the side of the houses at times, and it's difficult to find the exact same material to replace it with. So sometimes people will re-side a whole wall, and then we have dumpsters full of all this material. So that's really gives you an idea of the restoration project. It's looking at those. We could be sustainably harvesting cedar on the east end of Long Island. Cedar trees are indigenous trees. Now, that's something that would take years to do, but that's the kind of thing. So it's a regenerative advanced practice, actually farming. In fact, research has been done that now shows that the most sustainable building is built out of wood, because you can't propagate cement or steel. They take thousands of years to create these mineral resources, whereas we could be inventing and developing and revisiting all of these practices of sustainable farming that we have as a species used for thousands of years. It's really only after World War II that the experiment we have now of trying all these new materials and always coming up with what we think is a panacea. So the vinyl siding is not a panacea. It doesn't last forever. It needs maintenance. It's difficult to replace. Whereas if we look back at some of the other building materials, which isn't to say that we shouldn't have any new building materials, but that really is the idea of the restoration project. And the same with gardening and wooden boat building. There's a great little... I have a piece where we talk about the history of Hampton Bays. And if you looked at Hampton Bays in the 19th century, every yard was full of fruit trees. Children on the way home from school. There's a woman, Pat Tuccio, who's a member of the Hampton Bays Historical Society and Preservation Society board. And she recalls from her time growing up, walking by and just being able to pick berries from people's yards. There were tons of blueberries and strawberries. So that's the kind of thing we mean by restoring those practices.
Of course, now you have the deer, and they get to the berries. Fruit before we do.
I think there's two things. The development has been growing. We haven't stopped developing. There's a lot of lots for sale in Hampton Bays. One of the projects we're working on, we have a great land analyst. He's a student in the environmental design policy and planning major at Stony Brook University, R.J. Theofeld. We've been looking at, through GIS mapping, all of the undeveloped parcels that we have in Hampton Bays. So if we started to see all these undeveloped parcels as a corridor, and started actually planting out blueberries and the other things that deer eat, will attract them away. I mean, they've evolved to eat people's gardens because they've been pushed out of the traditional places. But we really have a contiguous natural landscape and could augment. So, for instance, this parcel that's around us, there are invasive species like Norway maples that are pushing out all of the local plants. So when a Norway maple goes up and gets full, it'll be a full size, 30, 60 foot in diameter tree, you'll see absolutely nothing growing around its roots because it actually puts out toxins through its roots. And the way the crown forms of the tree It sheds all the rain to the ground around it, so that it's very dry underneath it. And that's, you know, so the deer are going to places where there's more food because we have invasive Norway maples and other plants that are pushing what they would have had originally evolved to eat. So they're evolving to eat things that we're putting in our gardens. So that's one strategy we can use, is actually looking at the entire landscape from the beach all the way to Hubbard Park and Smithers Park and Black Duck Lodge and the Squiretown Park in Hampton Bays, looking at all of that landscape as one contiguous ecological corridor and creating corridors for the deer to be able to feed, move, and have genetic biodiversity. So that's one of the practices we like to do is not only plant food for human beings, but also plant food for other species so that we increase the biodiversity and they become less of a pest to us and we become less of a pest to them.
We're talking with Mark Fasanella of the Ecological Culture Initiative in Hampton Bays. Now, you're talking about restoring a landscape, but we are now in a period of anthropogenic climate change. Hampton Bays is pretty low in terms of sea level. What are your thoughts on resilience, restoration in the face of sea level rise and climate change?
It sounds very radical in the context of the time we live in. But once again, if you look at the landscape that you see here, it's a post-World War II landscape. You could push it back to post-World War I, but really it's a post-World War II landscape. All of the houses that are right up, and we're still building new houses right up against the edge of the water. And that's just something that will have to change in the 21st century. The Community Preservation Fund was established by the state, and it's one of those opt-in programs where a community can decide to create this tax on every real estate transfer. And there are funds available. And as these waterfront homes become available over the next 25, 50, 100 years, we need to purchase them and either pick them up and move them or take them down piece by piece and reuse those materials somewhere else and allow the marshes to come back in.
Mark, how do your neighbors feel about this, using the what was supposed to be a device to preserve open space being used to buy back the waterfront properties? How do people feel about that?
The Community Preservation Fund is not purchasing houses to create a more resilient landscape now. That's not a practice that is. I'm just saying that's something that could be done, and I think needs to be done in the 21st century. You know, people are resistant to change. Richard Casabianca, who owns this house, had a great phrase once at a community meeting. He said, there are two things that people despise, the way things are and change. So that's really, you know, you have to confront that and you have to confront it head on. It's not easy. And I'm not saying we're going to condemn people's houses and push them out of their houses. Ed Mazaria, who wrote the first book on passive solar architecture in the United States, has an analysis he uses that over 30 years in the United States, 75% over 30 years, 75% of all buildings that you see in the landscape are either torn down and rebuilt or renovated beyond recognition. That's just what we do at human beings. So you have to have that 30-year, 50-year perspective and be saying, okay, well, when this family decides they can no longer afford the taxes on this house, you know, maybe that's when you may. It's not a question of going in and condemning people's land and pushing them off their property. It's more a question of, once again, having this culture of understanding that we live in the water in Hampton Bays. We're surrounded by water. We're almost an island. If you look at the landscape, there's so much water around us. And it is going to rise. And we know what is called a slosh. The town has fantastic GIS mapping for where it will flood. We know where it will flood. So that's where we need to look first. Those are very easy things and say, well, on these properties, we're going to make a priority of saying that the houses in this slosh area will, over time, and you just let the people who live there know that if you ever want to give up this house, let us know, and the town will give you fair market value for it.
Well, there's going to be at some point when insurers are not going to insure houses any longer.
I think that's true, and I think that's already happening. I mean, if you know the history of West Hampton Dunes, it had to be kind of self-insured. So I think that is happening. It's becoming, and of course, if you know the history of Hurricane Sandy, they said that it wasn't flood damage that happened to some of the houses, but wind-driven water. So even if you are insured, it doesn't mean that you're actually insured for your house and the damage that could be done in the storm.
Absolutely. So now let's talk about Seed, The Untold Story. This is a film that is going to air tomorrow. Talk about the film and where can people see it?
Sure. SEED is kind of a little bit of a movement as a documentary that's going around trying to get people to understand this issue. For years, there's been talk about the loss of biodiversity in food seeds in particular, especially grains and grains that are used for livestock. Michael Pollan, who's probably the world's most famous food writer, has said that, you know, corn might actually be using us as a vector, as opposed to us propagating corn, because it is the most grown crop in the universe. And then if you follow that up with rice and wheat, and if you use Google Earth, it's a fantastic tool, and it really is worth doing. If you use Google Earth and you look around the Midwest United States, I mean, you will see miles and miles. The entire state of Ohio is basically just monocultures of either corn or soy or wheat. And so what's happening is the seed stock, the different types of plants, and of course that leaves us open to two things. It leaves us open to corporate exploitation in the sense that these seeds have been genetically modified to not self-propagate. So in other words, if a person plants corn and then they want to take some kernels of corn and replant it or rice, it won't properly grow the next season. You have to buy new seed stock from that manufacturer. And then they sell all kinds of products to use with that genetic modified seed to guarantee its high yield, and those are fertilizers and fungicides and pesticides. And then if you put other seed stock in that soil that you've used all of those products on, they won't propagate or have a high yield. So it's a real crisis in what we're doing in the land, and it is affecting waterways, entire rivers and aquifers, drinking aquifers. So that's really the issue of this film. And you'll see all of these activists who are both trying to preserve seeds. It's showing all the grassroots efforts like the Ecological Culture Initiative around the world. Kind of the leading proponent of that is Vandana Shiva. She's an Indian activist who's been working for years and in a fight against Monsanto in particular for really trying to monopolize seed stock in the same way that there's a few companies that own office software now, and that's the kind of market that we have. So this it's really an effort to push back against the tide of seeds being intellectual property and being something that you can patent. And of course, that's related to why we created the seed library in Hampton Bays. We're trying to do it at a very local level, and so are the activists in this movie. If you go to the ECI website, ECINY.org, the first thing you'll see is that logo, the image for SEED, and there's a link right there. You have to buy the tickets through this link. It's an organization called Gather Us that is kind of a community organization, activist organization that's trying to get these screenings of this film around the country.
You can find more about Mark Fasanella's Ecological Culture Initiative by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.